Temple Grandin. You don't have to come up here quite yet because we're going to be having some young people escorting you up, but she's getting ready. She's an awesome speaker. She's an American professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She's a best-selling author, an autistic activist, and a consultant to the livestock industry and animal behavior. She also invented the Hug Box, a device to calm those on the autism spectrum. The subject of an award-winning 2010 biographical film, Temple Grandin, she also was listed in Time 100 list of the 100 most influential people in the world in the heroes category. She is a prominent and widely cited proponent of the rights of autistic persons and of animal welfare. She's lectured widely about her firsthand experiences of the anxiety of feeling threatened by everything in her surroundings and of being dismissed and feared, which motivates her work in humane livestock handling processes. She studied the behavior of cattle, how they react to ranchers, movements, objects, and light. She then designed adapted curved corrals intended to reduce stress, panic, and injury in animals leading to slaughter and, frankly, in lots of other animal handling arrangements. Her business website promotes improvement of standards in slaughter plants and livestock farms. In 2004, she won a Proggy Award in the visionary category from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. One of her notable essays about animal welfare is Animals Are Not Things, in which she posits that technically animals are property in our society, but the law ultimately gives them ethical protections or rights. She compares those properties and rights of owning cows versus owning screwdrivers or other inanimate objects, enumerating how both may be used to serve human purposes in many ways, but when it comes to inflicting pain, there is a vital distinction between such properties. Legally, a person can smash or grind up a screwdriver, but cannot torture an animal. This afternoon, there was a screening of the movie that I referenced, held here during the convention. Hopefully, some of you had a chance to see it. Tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 4 o'clock, that movie will be screened again in the second floor. Not right here, but in, it's like out this way and up the stairs over that way, in what's called the Birch Room. That runs from 1 to 4. The movie will be shown twice. And I would highly encourage you to take the time to watch the movie. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce a true American, Temple Grandin. Please help me welcome her.
Well, it's great to be here. And I hope my slides, oh, good, my slides might actually work. That's always nice. And I've got a lot of different things to talk about tonight. I want to talk about different ways that people think and how they can work together to solve problems. Really important thing. You know, when I was young, I used to think everybody thought in pictures the way I thought in pictures. And it's been an interesting journey finding out that different people think differently. You know, Steve Jobs talks about thinking differently. You know, some people are more the artistic kind of mind. They're the industrial designers. That's what Apple's all about, art. And then the engineers, the mathematicians, had to make the inside of the phone work. So you do need the two different kinds. You know, in a lot of industries, there's conflicts. And I think a lot of the conflicts that you have in different industries is misunderstanding about how different people think. You know, in the computer industry, it's the techies fighting the suits. You know, the startup starts out, and then they finally got to hire some suits to keep it organized. In academia, and I was just out at a really, really great Society for Range Management meeting, you get the conflict between the people in the field that work on things like pasture rotation, and then the academics say it doesn't work. And then you get an argument about science. Is observation really science? Does everything have to be quantified data? The artists fight the accountants. And then in my field, animal behavior, you have ethology, which is the study of animals in natural conditions, versus people that kind of do stimulus response. You know, some of these conflicts are kind of stupid. I read this really dumb thing online about somebody who's going to go work for the government. They said, well, do I have to wear a suit? And then you get into real serious disputes about what is real science. I used to fight with my major professor about what is science. Also used to fight with him about discrete versus continuous variables. And he said, weight's a continuous variable. And I said, what about the truck scale that weighs in 5-pound increments? And then the statisticians got real silent. Observation is part of science. What about astronomy? What would be the control for the Hubble Space Telescope? Well, maybe it pointed at the ground. That would be the control. And it was at one time a spy satellite, so maybe they already have the control data, but it's classified. Then you take things like epidemiology. Okay, you know, one case of Ebola breaks out, you know, food poisoning or something breaks out, and then you start figuring out the pattern. Observation is the beginning of things that you can make hypotheses about for controlled experiments. When I learned that my thinking was different from verbal thinking, it sort of gave me a different approach to problem solving. I can remember when I was really young, I used to go, well, they designed that thing wrong because they were stupid. Well, now I've learned that in some cases that was designed wrong because they didn't see the mistake. I'm going to tell you how we need to have both visual thinkers like me, and you also need the mathematician type of thinker too. This is one of my most important slides. This is the different kinds of minds. And I talk about this in my book, The Autistic Brain. Yes, and we will be selling books afterwards. And I am a photorealistic visual thinker. Everything that I think about is a picture. The HBO movie does a great job of showing how visual thinking works. If you want to know how visual thinking works, the movie will show you exactly how it works. Can't do algebra. In fact, I'm getting concerned that some of the stuff going on in the school systems today is going to screen out a lot of good visual thinkers. People that would make really great people in farming, too. And then you have the pattern thinker. These are the mathematicians, the engineers, the computer programmers. You know, if you got a little third grader and he's really, really super good at math, don't make him do baby math. You know, give him the more difficult book. You know, everybody's not the same. And when they get stuck with a label, it could be autism, it could be ADHD, it could be dyslexia, well, they tend to work too much on the deficit. I'm seeing too many smart kids that ought to be working out in the fields and doing jobs with animals getting kind of a handicap mentality. Because the problem you have with a diagnosis like autism is it goes all the way from Einstein with no language until age 3 to somebody who can't talk and has, you know, much more severe handicaps. You know, I'm a professor first, and the autism comes second. Then you got the verbal facts guy. Knows everything about, you know, various things that interest them. And some people learn better through their ears. Now, what are some of the characteristics of visual thinking? I'm also a bottom-up thinker. And I find that this totally affects my approach to problem solving. Concepts consist of specific examples. And you take specific examples, you start putting them into categories. You know, when you think in words, you tend to think more top-down. There's a tendency when you think in words to overgeneralize. And I find this happens all the time when I get asked about different problems. And I don't care if it's a cattle problem, it's a problem with a piece of equipment, or it's a problem with a kid in the classroom. They'll say something like, my dog is crazy. What do I do about a crazy dog? Or my kid's got behavior problems in the classroom. Well, I don't know what to do about it. I don't have enough information. How old? Can he talk? Exactly what did the kid do? Visual thinkers also tend to notice details. This helped me in my work with animals because it's sensory-based, it's not word-based. Also, I am an associative thinker. So I think about one thing, I start to get associations. It's not linear. And for certain types of problem-solving, visual thinking is really a good thing. Another thing I've learned is I worked 20 years designing projects, supervising the construction of projects. In fact, half the cattle in this country are handled in the center track restrainer I designed for meatpacking plants. And you can go look at that equipment on Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. And when you design things and supervise the construction, you then have to start them up and make them work. Well, growing a crop is the same sort of thing. Well, the goal is producing the crop. It's all about outcomes. When you work in the real world, it's all about real outcomes. It's not about theoretical stuff. One of my big concerns with a lot of policymakers is you're getting students now, get a degree in political science, maybe it's law or philosophy or some other thing, get a job in the government, and then they're making policy about stuff, and it's all super abstract. I was out at Davis, I talked to an English class, I was in Harvard, I talked to some political science students, it was all an abstraction, social injustice or something. I don't know what I'm going to do about that. You better pick out something you can actually get your head around that you can actually fix, something real. Now, in the very first work I did with cattle, I noticed they were afraid of a lot of little things that most people don't notice, like a white jug on the fence, seeing the car through the fence, little visual details, a chain hanging down on a chute, a coat slung over a fence. Now, how many people here noticed how that animal was looking at the sunbeam? Okay, raise your hand if you noticed that. I don't know. I thought people out working in the fields would notice these sort of things better. Well, now you've got some GPS thing that you're spending $8,000 a year to subscribe to that's going to tell you where there's differences in the field. And if it breaks, you can't run the tractor. I learned some interesting things on the way in from the airport this afternoon. Okay, look at how those animals have an ear on each other, noticing little details of posture. And I always get asked by many people, do they know they're going to get slaughtered? I found they were much more scared of things like the dark, a hose on the floor, a reflection. You could move some lights, and then the cattle would walk right in. Then I asked my students things they could fix in this picture. And most of them will see the chain hanging down. But they don't see all these people standing there that shouldn't be there. Now, an animal being sensory-based, cattle are going to perceive a man on a horse as something different than a man on foot. It's a different picture when you think about it visually. So it's really important to train them to both, because some of the most dangerous cattle are ones that see their first man on foot at an auction market, a feed yard, or a packing plant, because their flight zone might be 3 foot to the guy on the horse, and when you first bring them into the auction market, their flight zone is 50 foot in a 30-foot pen. That's rather dangerous. Visual thinking has been a big asset in my work as a designer. Now, I laid out this crowd pen in a full half circle. Okay, you're laying out a round crowding tongue, make it a full half circle to take advantage of that tendency to go back to where they come from. You want to use that behavior, and you got to lay things out correctly. I've been working on some real simple designs where the handler just stands there right there at the pivot point at the gate, and the cattle will come right on around you. All right, let me show you how associative thinking works. Well, you give me a keyword like shoes. Well, I saw some childhood shoes, and I had to wear these to church, and I had these little petticoats I hated. Now I'm going through all the clothes I had to wear that I absolutely hated. And I see these shoes, and then I see some other shoes with much better childhood memories. I'm really glad to see that our stuff's coming back in style. I think that's just wonderful. And that is now high fashion style. That's what we wore in the 50s. I guess the Chinese know how to make them just fine. And there's the shoe that I wear today, an Ariat boot. And how did I get from an Ariat boot to a mud puddle? Well, just recently I was doing a talk on a college campus, and there was lots of slush and stuff around, and I was trying to avoid walking in the mud puddles. So that's how I got from a boot to a mud puddle. See, it's associative. And there actually is scientific evidence that these two types of visualizers exist. I've got all these references in my book, The Autistic Brain, but this is a real thing. You've got the photorealistic visual thinker who thinks in pictures. Then you've got the mathematician who thinks in patterns. It's patterns. Think extreme origami. Think chess. That's pattern thinking. Now, when you're a weird geek, one of the things I had to learn is I had to learn how to sell my work. I was not very good at interviewing, but when people looked at my drawings, they'd go, wow, You did that. I think we got a pretty good projector here. It's showing up great on this TV down here. Okay. I used to joke around that a huge visual thinking circuit in my head. Turns out that I do. It's been interesting, you know, like checking out all the latest high-tech brain scan stuff. That goes all the way from primary visual cortex, where the graphics files are located, to the frontal cortex. That's why when I give a keyword, I get pictures. Well, there's a normal circuit for speak what you say. In other words, it goes from the visual cortex up to the language cortex. That's the normal one. That's mine. I got a lot of extra pushes. And now I pay a price for that on speak what you see. I had speech delay. Now the thing is, you look at stuff like this, and if you were to go out and scan 100 people, you're going to find a lot of variation in how many extra bushes are on there. At what point does that become an abnormality? You see, having autism, a little bit of autism, half of Silicon Valley's got some autism. Yes, and the human resources people in Silicon Valley will say, yes, we know that, we don't talk about it. So what I'm seeing is one little geeky kid gets to have fun at the Googleplex. Oh, and they're building new headquarters. You want to see the new Apple mothership. It's going to cost over $5 billion. That's equal in price to the Denver airport. You see, I like to convert things to real things I can see. What does $5 billion actually buy you? Well, it buys you everything at the Denver airport except things that fly and things that drive. But everything else is provided. Land, electricity, water, everything else. Now, I paid a price for those extra bushes, for all this visual thinking. I got less bandwidth for speak what you see. Well, that's why I had speech delay. Well, this kind of shows the math department pretty well wrecked, because what's blue is full of water. And I'm getting really worried with all this stuff now on Common Core and everything, screening out us visual thinkers. You need us. You know, when you look at farming, who invents a lot of the really cool new equipment? It's a farmer. Then the equipment companies, they just perfect it. They don't invent a lot of the stuff. Okay, when I was in college, I wanted to learn computer programming. In 1968, Bill Gates and I had access to this state-of-the-art machine, and he could do it, and I was just not able to do it. You know, you get into this whole discussion about innate abilities, and I think where they make the biggest difference is where there's an extreme ability or extreme disability. And well, working memory, multitasking, pretty hopeless. To give you a little glimpse into the mind of the mathematician, that praying mantis is made out of a single sheet of folded paper. No scissors. And what you see in the background, that's the folding pattern. That's certainly not my mind. There's some other little great little things that people have made with folding. And when I asked an astrophysicist to tell me about a church steeple, he saw motion and patterns of people praying. I see individual church steeple pictures. And I was shocked when I was working on my book, Thinking in Pictures, when I asked a speech therapist, church steeple, and she goes, pointy thing. I don't get any pointy thing. I just see specific ones. There's different ways to do the math. We get into arguments about how to teach reading, how to teach math. Use a variety of techniques. I was a phonics learner. Another kid might be a whole word learner. You know, what we want to do is get the end result. Okay, you grow the crop and harvest it, or you want the kid to learn how to read. You know, all about end results. And there's some new study that was just done, again, showing evidence for the two types of visual thinking. Okay, what are some different ways to look at differences in thinking and problem solving? I'm an associational thinker. I make associations that something is like something else. Word thinkers tend to be much more linear, step by step. I think in pictures and patterns versus words, bottom up versus top down. When you get too much in words, you get too much top down, too abstract, just into ideology. Bottom up, I solve problems with specific examples. All right, let's say I was going to work on education, for example. Well, let's take five or six examples of schools that really work. In other words, their students graduate, stay out of trouble with the law, get into great careers, and schools are absolutely horrible. Okay, what are some of the common denominators of the horrible places and the really good places? You can sometimes really learn a lot looking at the really worst and the really good. And you can be more social or less social. And for me, I use specific examples to make concepts. Okay, my concept of what an airplane is, it's based on specific examples. Okay, we can put them in categories, jet airplanes, small airplanes like Cessnas. You can make different categories. Fighter jets, you can put, you know, you can make categories. But it's specific examples. It's not a generalization. I think we need to look at personality traits sort of like a music mixing board. You know, it's no black and white dividing line. So one gifted kid goes to gifted, another little kid goes to Silicon Valley, and then another kid ends up playing video games and Social Security because nobody taught him social rules. Not good. What would happen to little Steven today? A weird loner. He brought snakes to school and turned them loose. How about little Albert? No language until age 3. How many drugs would they have him sozzled up on? Not a good idea. I'm seeing too many kids labeled autism, dyslexia, things like this, and I'm worried our educational system's going to screen them out, and we need them to solve a lot of problems in the future, problems with water and energy and all kinds of things like that. Here's some examples of major CEOs that were dyslexic. There's an article done by Pet Betsy Morris. The guy who started JetBlue was ADHD, and an IKEA guy was dyslexic. Different kinds of minds. Steve Jobs was an artist. And then the engineers have to make the inside of the phone work. So, okay, math freaks. Every time you use a smartphone, remember, an artist did that. Apple's run by artists. All right, now I'm going to show you why you need my kind of visual mind. When I found out what caused the Fukushima disaster, I couldn't believe it. They made a basic visual thinking mistake. I can't design a nuclear reactor, but if I'd been drawing up all the concrete drawings, and that's something I would have been capable of doing, I would have gone, ooh, we got a little problem here. If the seawall is breached, we're going to be in big trouble because all the emergency cooling equipment and the generator that runs it is in a non-waterproof basement. Electric pumps and generators do not run underwater. Everybody in this room knows that. That's the mistake that they made. Some simple watertight doors and it would not have happened. And the other mistake they made was social. They never called for help. And if somebody that's ruled by logic, I said, how could you let 3 reactors burn up and you didn't call for help? Oh, terrible. You know, I'm worried today that too many kids are removed from the world of practical things. You know, there's a big shortage of people in skilled trades, and of course we know we need to be getting more and more young people into farming. Big concern. This is the kind of stuff that really saved me in high school. I was bullied and teased. Also, practical hands-on things teach practical problem solving. I'm horrified that states like Illinois cut funding for FFA. California managed to save FFA by having students write handcrafted, and I want to emphasize handcrafted, emails and letters to the governor. And that saved the FFA program. You know, we've got consumers today that are totally removed from the world of practical things. So they have really unrealistic ideas about, slaughter plants can be made perfect. I go, no way. You can make them really good, but I can't make them perfect. No way. We need these hands-on classes. People have to ask me, how did you find your interest in cattle? I was exposed to them in high school. I get asked by a lot of students, how do you get interested in careers? Well, you get interested in careers you get exposed to. And a lot of kids aren't getting exposed to enough stuff. Not a good thing. Well, and a lot of people don't have any respect for people that work with their hands because you take the cover off the jet engine, it's a real complicated thing, and I want all those little tubes on my airplane to work. Really important little tubes there, and they better work. They better get a little more respect for that. Young people today want to know where food comes from. They really want to know. And we need to be showing them where it comes from. You know, I'm going to be going to MIT tomorrow. I've got to get up and take a real early flight. I was at Harvard recently, been out to UC Davis talking to an English class. It's all an abstraction. And they talk about it in a way that's so abstract it's kind of scary. You know, young people want to know. And what a lot of surveys have showed is local is really important. Local keeps showing up, and you know why? I think deep down inside, they see that Walmart truck go by, and they think, what would happen if the Walmart truck doesn't come? That would be a real bad deal. Students are really removed from agriculture. 31% have never been on a farm. Another thing I kind of thought about this fall, I was doing my regular lecture in my animal handling class, and I go over some of the consumer survey stuff. And something that comes up in survey after survey after survey, big is bad. Every survey that comes up. And as I got to thinking, it's not bad, it's fragile. It's extremely fragile. So then my visual thinking mind saw the electric towers from 2007, 4 miles of them, bent over like this. It was in Kansas. Just bent over, like a giant had stepped on them, just crushed. They were scrap steel. Somebody out in San Francisco got up on a hill and shot up $15 million worth of electrical substation. 100-year-old technology, very difficult and expensive to replace. The whole mess with the ports. Out on the West Coast, there was beef rotting out there that couldn't be sent to Japan. Big is fragile. Deep down inside, I think that might have something to do with some of the interest in buying local. I think we need to think about that. I'm very concerned about disease resistance in some of our high-producing animals. I've actually looked up some of the literature on this. I like to play with Google Scholar. You know, then you get into questions like the antibiotics problem. It's not the meat that's a problem, you're dumping it on the land. Just remember, antibiotics come from the land. If you think I'm full of it, you can go on Google Scholar, type Scholar into Google, you'll see a link comes up, says Google Scholar, you get a new search box, use some keywords like soil, antibiotic resistance, manure, antibiotic resistance, three keywords. You will see abstracts come up. And They're very, that's the kind of abstracts that they are. Woo. Okay. Well, we do have some problems that some people just are so removed that 50% of young adults in the UK fail to connect pigs with bacon. I go, really? Yeah, really? There's a great exhibit outside of Chicago, Pig Adventure and Fair Oaks Dairy. Great big, huge operations, open to the public. And I asked them, what's the most common weird question they got about the pigs? Are those actually pigs? And I said, is there any particular one demographic that says that? No, all ages. I guess they think they're Disney animatronic pigs. No, they're not. And I'm worried about people getting more and more into their silos. The internet magnifies the voices of radicals, right or left on an issue. It gives radicals a big voice. And as we get more and more mobile apps, we got some young, very young people today that don't know what Googling is. In other words, they're getting off of the big, huge, overall internet. And I'm worried about people getting in silos. In my career, I've always worked on trying to kind of knock down silos. And so I wanted to go find this picture on Google Images of blowing up a silo. Well, so I looked through all these pictures, and then I found this one. They're not blowing it up. What they're doing is chewing it down with a hydraulic jaw. And I actually think this is a better picture. We got to really work hard on chewing down, you know, the barriers and, you know, communicating with other people. This is why I'll take a go from a farm meeting here, go to MIT, provided my planes cooperate, and then go and do an autism talk and go do something up in South Dakota. And we need to be getting young people back into real things. I don't think it's good when a Harvard graduate's whole goal in life is to work for Goldman Sachs, which some programmer liked it when you spell it wrong, it said something else. Our best and our brightest ought to be solving water problems or energy problems, you know, stuff that really matters. That's what they need to be doing. So how do we get kids interested in interesting things? First of all, you got to show them interesting things. I got really interested in science, studying optical illusions. I also had a great science teacher. I was reading a nice article today on the plane about, you know, retirees mentoring students. We need to be doing more of that. There's one of my designs in SketchUp. There's lots of free stuff on the internet. You can make that SketchUp, and then really cool, you want to print it on a 3D printer. This gets the virtual world back to the real world. It's like a little glue gun. It's not electronic when it prints it. So there's a lot of things I want to get you to be thinking about. We got to work on getting some of our best and the brightest involved in farming. The problem is, a lot of the stuff you do, they just don't know about it. We got to work on chewing down those silos. Let's work on chewing them down. Something worth doing. Thank you for coming. I'd be happy to take a few questions.
Would you like to take questions?
Yeah, I can take a few questions, sure. Well, if I'd be happy to take a few questions, if anybody has any questions. Otherwise, you probably want to get on to doing some other things, like work, you know, getting drunk in the hospitality suites. No. Okay. Shouldn't have said that. Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with some of that. Yeah, there's a lot of problems in multiple systems in the body. Well, the question concerned the problems with the gut and autism, and there is research studies that show that kids with autism and adults with autism have more gastrointestinal problems than most other people. And in my book, The Way I See It, I do have one chapter about that. Yeah, there is a tendency for those things to be linked. How to get children to eat fresh fruits and vegetables. So they don't, I notice a lot of the convenience stores now are selling them now, and sometimes people aren't buying them. And they've got some pretty dead looking apples at some of these stores. I think one of the things is we need to be introducing fruits and vegetables to very young children. That was what was done with me. And I loved all those things. If you introduce them young, then they're going to eat them. We need to be doing that. You get into all these concerns about people say, well, you know, meat's bad for your health and stuff. I think what's happening is people that eat a lot of meat tend to not be eating a lot of fruits and vegetables. I remember going to a farmers meeting in the UK, and they had all kinds of good fruits and vegetables out there, and they ate none of it. I ate a bunch of it. Any other questions? Maybe I'll pick somebody. Okay? Maybe I'll just pick somebody. It might be a good thing to do.
I'm sure they will find you.
Well, I'll be around after the banquet. Thank you for coming.
I have a gift for you.
Oh, okay.
This is a commemorative pen that we've had coined for the National Farmers Union.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.